She lies on the cold sand, and responses come to her, and she throttles them down, thinking, "You have to do this, and you have to do this carefully." She thinks, "This one is on you. It really is on you. You have to tell him something, and it has to be the right thing, and it might save your life." She says, "One time, my daddy had me do pull-ups off the rafter, and he..." Her voice fails her. Hitches. She doesn't know what to say. Can't believe she's saying he... What? She doesn't know herself. She says, "He put that knife between my legs, so that if I fell from the rafter..." Again, she doesn't know. If she fell from the rafter, what? "And he... There is a horror, almost a disbelief in the telling, like she can't believe she's doing it, as if she can't believe it's even possible to talk about. "And he asked me to do pull-ups, and I did them. You reach a point where the next pull-up hurts so bad. You'd think you could do pull-ups until you just couldn't anymore. You wouldn't have to make yourself do pull-ups, because, well, there's a knife between your legs. But that's not how it is. Every pull-up is still a choice, and to do them, it takes discipline and it takes courage. You think, 'I don't have to do this pull-up.' You want to give up. And you start thinking maybe it's a good idea, because the pain of holding on to the rafter becomes greater than the threat of death. Because then it wouldn't hurt anymore. Because holding steady is, there is this bad, really bad sense of uncertainty. An uncertainty so painful, so asshole clenching, that it becomes, it's an awful thing to say, but it's easier to let go and be split in fucking half than it is to try and hold on, suffering and not knowing what is going to happen. That's courage. Taking your own fucking life in your own fucking hands when that is the hardest thing you can do. No one thinks of it. Everybody thinks they do the right thing, but that's not true. They don't understand how scary it is, how hard it is. No one understands unless they've been there. We're there now, Jacob, and you're going to do the right thing despite the fear and despite the hurt." He is listening to her, sawing carefully back and forth, the bow turning the spindle. "Hold on to it," she says. He is silent, breathing in time to the steady working of the bow, back and forth. She can hear from his breathing how exhausted he is. His right hand works forward and back, while his left bears steadily down on the handboard. She watches him for a long time. She is cut loose, adrift in her mind. She thinks, "Stay awake. Stay awake." She feels staked to the sand. The waves rise and retreat on the beach, and despite herself, and despite the cold eating into her bones, she falls asleep and wakes feeling herself half dead. The moon cresting the island. The light crept up from the waterline like a pale tide, crept over her, and not yet climbed onto Jacob, who crouches in the dark. The knife, stuck in the sand, casts a long shadow. She can hear, above the ocean, swish and grind, a kind of panting susurration in Jacob's breathing, and she realizes that he is whispering, "Come on, come on," over and over, and that the raggedness of his intonation matches his breathing and matches the working of the bow. An orange glow expands and retreats with the working of the spindle and lights him from beneath, his whole body bent with the power of his will. Blood drips from the points of his hair, and the blood-slick hollows and panes of his face catch the cinder's nascent light. Turtle, looking deep into these shadowed features, finds a color, a red that is as dark as black, like the afterimage of a color. She has never seen another person this way, and she has no words for it. It's as if he has quenched down within himself every doubt, filled his mind only with the possibility of fire, the spindle smoking in the socket, and glowing orange powder falling from the socket's notch into the tinder. Turtle's gut seethes with anticipation. Then, with a crack, the wooden bow breaks and Jacob's susurration changes to a no, 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 and he throws aside the broken bow and takes the spindle in two open palms and rolls it forward and back, breathing but not saying, come on, baby, come on, baby. And then she sees what he sees. The tinder has begun to smolder. He tosses the spindle aside, takes up a wad of smoldering grass and lint, and he turns it over, raising it into the cold air of the cove. The glow ekes across the sand, enclosing the both of them in its burbling red light. Jacob, in the privacy of utter preoccupation, stooped over the tinder and blowing it into life, and Turtle, lying with her hands trapped in her armpits. There is a moment where she knows that the tinder will catch and quicken to flame, and she opens her mouth in painful excitement, thinking, oh my God, oh my God. And then, in the wet ocean air, the tinder bleeds out to dull orange, the coals attenuated along the lint, smoking and going white. And then the fire dies. Jacob holds the dead tinder cupped in his hands, rocked back onto his butt in astonishment. And she draws him toward herself and takes him in her arms. And she sinks her good fingers into his flesh, digging into him. And he allows her to hold him. And they wait out the cold night this way. 18. Turtle wakes with water beaded on her eyelashes. She blinks it away and sits up from her wallow of cold sand. Her back throbs, swollen and sick feeling. Her hands are scabbed to her shirt. Everything is swallowed in fog. She can hear the waves netting the cobbles in and hauling them out again. And she can make out the dark line of the tide and nothing else. There is no sun, only a diffuse gray light, the sand slick and black except for the sand dollars. The dew condenses on the leaning cliff face above them and drips steadily around them. Turtle's hair is wet with it. She climbs up to the island's top. The weeds are frosted with dew. She lays herself face down in the dewy grass and it wets her skin. Shivering and shaking, she brings her dry mouth to the grass stalks and sucks the moisture from the blades. The water is delicious. She rolls over onto her back in the cold, wet grass. Jacob, she croaks. Jacob. Her voice will not carry, so she crawls to the island's edge and croaks down at him until he wakes, looking wildly around before he looks up. She grins for him. Blood from her lips runs down her chin. Wow, he says, his voice breaking. That is the sound of nightmares. He gathers their things and climbs up toward her. They lie bending grass stalks into their mouths, sucking dew from the blades. Below, the tide climbs onto the beach. Turtle finds a small, oily black scat filled with broken crab shells. Jacob, she says. He crawls through the grass toward her. What is that? She prizes her hand from out of the bloody, sand-crusted rind of her shirt and teases the scat with a bird bone. Raccoon scat. Are there raccoons on this island? She buries her face in it, inhaling deeply, closing her eyes against the must.
Blue fruit, Jacob says. Notes of leather, gaminess.
It's moist, she says, filled with a big, pleasurable, hopeful delight.
Medium tannins, Jacob says.
Day before yesterday, the moon was waxing gibbous, almost full.
People don't know this about you, that you have a strange, poetical, and associative intelligence. Now, I'm imagining this raccoon laying a deuce beneath a waxing gibbous moon while waves break on the rocks.
Full moon tonight, or almost.
I wish I understood what you were talking about.
I know how we're going to get home. They crawl to the island's landward edge and lie in the grass looking out into the fog. Stocky, blooming succulents nest in the sandstone, their scales powdered blue. The surf is gentler than the day before. The island is the tip of a long, underwater ridge of rock. Several such run out through the shallows. They are very black with green-blue kelp-choked furrows between them.
Do you remember the tides yesterday? Turtle says.
She turns over in the grass, lies looking up at the clouds, counts the tides off on her fingers.
You got to my house a little before 7 a.m. By 9-ish, we'd gotten ourselves here.
The tide was coming in, and it peaked around 11, and it wasn't very big. We stayed up on top of the island because we were afraid. Then sometime that afternoon, let's say around 3 p.m., it went out. It was down to about 2 feet. That's when we went down to the beach. We collected stuff to make the bow drill. Then we had to come back onto the island because a real big tide came in. It was 5 or 6 feet high. It peaked around 10 last night, maybe as late as midnight. That's 3 tides. After midnight, the tide began going out again. That's when I woke you up. We went back down to the beach, and you tried to work the bow drill. And when it didn't work, we fell asleep down on the beach. But what we didn't know was that the tide kept going out all night. It was the biggest of the set, a very, very low tide, and it would have been at its lowest just before sunrise. It was probably 1 foot down past zero, 1.5 feet down. That's about 5 feet down from where you see it now.
Jacob is staring out at the rocks. Most of those rocks aren't but 1 foot underwater.
Yeah.
You could walk across all that rock to shore. Hell, you could wade out through the shallows.
Dry, mucusy pleats on her lips crack and weep.
So you're saying that while we slept, a land bridge appeared between us and the mainland, and we missed it? We were lying on the beach, cold, suffering, dying, but we could have just gotten up and walked home?
We couldn't have seen it from here, because the beach faces the ocean and probably deep water. We would have had to be looking towards shore, on the other side of the island. But yeah, we weren't looking. We didn't know. We didn't think. And we missed it.
You barely made it through the night, Turtle.
She nods. It was a simple mistake, and it almost killed them.
And this low, low tide will happen again tonight?
Yes. They wait in the wet grass together until the fog lifts. Turtle's face begins to burn, and she can see the skin on her arms glazed white and crackled. She covers her face with her flannel and stares out through a nook. The sun is high above them and a little to the southwest. The light flashes and glitters off the ocean. Turtle watches.
Hey, she says. Did you say you found a soda can?
Yeah. Bring it over here?
Sure.
She takes the Sprite can and begins polishing the shiny, concave bottom with the edge of her shirt. She dabs a little soil onto her wet forefinger and uses that to polish it to a mirror shine. She holds the can upside down in the crook of her knee, the bottom angled at the sun. Then she takes up their bird's nest of tinder and hovers the scraps above the concave mirror. A bright bead of light appears, vibrating with turtles shaking hands, throwing off crisscrossing loops of glare. And she works the tinder closer to the concave mirror until the spark contracts to a needle point of white-hot light. Within 15 minutes, the tinder is smoking. Bright red cinders appear among the threads. She lifts it up and blows the fire into life. She sets the flaming bundle in the grass and begins to take up the wooden kindling they'd prized from the driftwood. Jacob says, "Damn." She grins hugely. Jacob drags up driftwood from the cove before it is covered by the tide and hacks it to kindling with the Bowie knife. She shows him how to hammer the blade down with a driftwood club, essentially using the knife as a splitting wedge. Working steadily, Jacob splits whole logs into kindling, and when the fire is going big enough, she has Jacob fill the Sprite can with water. She connects it to a soda bottle with a long, hollow strand of bull kelp, cutting away the kelp bulb to make a nozzle that fits over the can. She puts the can in the fire. The steam rises into the flexible hose and condenses into the plastic soda bottle. The first capfuls are salty. Then it's good. They lie, tending their fire, absorbed in the meditative distillation of water. "Just wait," Jacob says, "when you're stranded, alone and fearful, upon the bleak, windswept island that is your freshman English class, broken on the rocks that are the Scarlet Letter. I will take your hand and say, 'Be not afraid. The moon is waxing gibbous, the scat is moist, and smells of manzanita berries,' and you will be amazed." Turtle is careful to smile only very fractionally. "I feel pretty sunburned. How do I look?" She crinkles her eyes at him. "Bad, huh?"
"Bad, yeah."
"This escape plan better work. The parental units will expect me back from Brett's on Monday."
"They won't be mad?"
"Yeah, probably, when they see my face. My mom will be all, 'Do you want to die of skin cancer?'"
"You'll be safe, though?" He laughs. Then he quits laughing. "What is it?" she asks.
"Nothing."
"Tell me." He just shakes his head. They sleep most of the day. They tend the fire and drink water by the cupful. The ocean swallows the beach and retreats. Smoky ramparts of clouds appear on the horizon, and the sun sets beneath them, a faraway, blood-red fist.
"Do you think your dad is right?" he says.
"To withdraw from the social contract?"
"I don't know."
"But what do you think?" "If it happens, if it really happens, the house can't be defended."
Jacob is silent at this.
After a long time, he lies down beside the fire and goes to sleep. Turtle, sitting on the island, feels level with the setting sun. The moon hangs in the east, breaking above the mainland, a deeper, smokier red. Swells of wine-dark water rise around her and sweep past, gathering as the coastal shelf inclines beneath them, their great bent backs glossed red and purple. They break against the bluffs and raise and collapse, spuming towers of a height with the moon. She stands guard as night falls and as the moon climbs into the sky. Sometime that night, in the dark, she hears the beginning of the low tide by the swish and grind of the freshly revealed cobbles.
Jacob sleeps his exhausted sleep. She is cross-legged, waiting out the moon. It will arc across the sky and begin to set in the west before they can go. Exhaustion rises and falls through her mind like a tide itself, and she thinks, "You are still, and you watch, and you wait." She thinks, "Wait. You wait, you bitch, and you watch, and you do not miss the moment." She thinks, "You have this at least. You have yourself, and you can do with that what you will, turtle." The smoky red moon wheels through the night, and when it lights the island slantwise from the southwest, casting a long silver path along the water, she rises and walks to the landward edge. Stone spurs stand up from the ocean floor in long, diagonal slashes, wet and glossed with moonlight. The island sits like a castle on the end of its causeway, the landward side too steep to climb, the western face slanting down to the small cove, which fronts deep water. She wakes Jacob gently, touching his face and saying his name. They descend to the beach. The island is footed in a vast black tide pool. The sand ramps down into that cold, unmoving water. Jacob is afraid. From within its depth, faint glimmers. Across its surface, the dappled reflections of the starry vault. They wade out into the water holding hands, shivering with cold, and then release each other and plunge forward and swim, both of them wounded, floundering. Jacob clambers, grasping onto the next stand of rocks. Turtle begins to climb out after him, stops, stands arrested. A ridge of black flesh breaks the surface, and she reaches out and puts her good hand on a scaled flank. It turns, drops beneath the surface, and Turtle cannot guess the size of the thing. She waits, and the flank lays out of the water again, and she puts her hands on it and feels an enormous strength there. A firm, muscled body beneath the scales. Jacob stands on the rock behind her, looking on, and Turtle takes a step back down into the water. The darkness and the moonlight move in slippery patterns across its surface. "Turtle," Jacob says warningly. She looks into the dark water. She takes a second step down off the rock, and something brushes against her leg. Something circles, and she feels the passage of its flank, 6 feet, maybe more. "What are you doing?" he says. She looks up at him as if breaking from a spell, and climbs back out. The rocks themselves are slippery and hard to climb, so Turtle and Jacob keep to the sandy passageways among the outcroppings, hip deep in water. Crabs move atop the rocks on either side, the creatures silhouetted against the blue-black sky, turning themselves cautiously sideways, lifting their claws into the air, their legs clicking on the stone. The water grows shallower and rockier. Holding hands, Turtle and Jacob move haltingly. They feel their way. They are careful of urchins. Even so, it takes less than 20 minutes to find their way up onto a small, private beach beneath Turtle's neighbor's house. There is a redwood staircase that climbs onto a wide lawn with Monterey cypresses and a large mermaid fountain lit by underwater lights. Near them, the neighbor's redwood mansion, with its wall-to-wall picture windows, an empty room, empty couches, a table, light slanting from the kitchen. They follow a gravel driveway out onto the highway, and a single car slows as it passes them, the headlights cutting across rattlesnake grass and wild oats, lighting them brilliantly, then going past. They walk along the road, listening to the quiet ocean. They limp up her driveway, sticking to its grassy median. And in through the door, Jacob leaving bloody heel prints on the boards. They sleep on the floor of her room, on wool blankets and under her sleeping bag, holding each other, exhausted, waking, each as the other rises to drink more water, glugging it down their dry throats and sighing and then standing, listening to the creaking of the old house. 19. Jacob wakes them early. "Come on, come on, come on," he says, rousting her up off the floor where she lies face down, protesting into the blankets. "Come on," he says. "We gotta get you clean and fed, and I gotta get home. Come on, come on. You're excited, I can tell. My parents will be home from the airport soon, and seriously, I best be there." He gets her up. He has made oatmeal pancakes. They're on a platter on the counter. "The power's out," he says, "but I guess you know that. I checked the eggs in a glass of water. They seem to be okay, if not ideal. You haven't been to buy groceries in a while, have you? Though, you're not exactly strapped for non-perishables." She sits on a towel on the bathroom floor with her left hand lying out in front of her, curled and broken like a crab left at the tide line. Jacob has found the first aid supplies under the sink and has boiled a basin of water and has laid out the wound sponges, irrigation syringes, splints, and gauze. He reads the directions on each sponge and ointment, Turtle watching with deadpan incredulity. "Okay, okay," he says, rubbing his hands together, psyching himself up. He puts on latex examination gloves and begins to cut away the sand-crusted flannel shirt bandages. Her pinky finger comes into view. He says, "Whoa. Oh, okay. So, wow." "I'm fine," she says around the thermometer. He pulls out the thermometer and frowns at it. 99.2. "You have a fever." "I run hot," she says. Jacob has put peanut butter on some of the pancakes. She takes one off the platter, folds it in two, and takes a bite. 99.2 is not normal. She says, taking another bite. "For me it is." "We need to go to the hospital, Turtle." "These pancakes aren't bad," she says. Jacob fills the syringe from a copper pot of hot, soapy water and begins irrigating the wound. The water drains pink into the basin.
"So, what do you have against hospitals?"
"My daddy doesn't like them."
"Where is he?"
She selects another pancake with her free hand.
"Marlowe hasn't found him yet, then," he says. "And you're afraid that if Child Protective Services gets wind of that, they'll take you away."
She has nothing to say. There is a little too much peanut butter on her pancake, and it's giving her trouble. She chews mightily.
"Maybe they should take you away."
"You don't think that," she says after a heroic swallow.
"No," he says. "I think that the system is probably completely fucked and Kafka-esque. I think you don't want to be part of it. But I do think you need a doctor."
"No doctors," she says.
"If I don't trust you to make your own decisions, I don't know who I would trust. But please, Turtle, let's go to the hospital."
"No,
I'm begging you."
She is silent.
Begging.
There's nothing to say. "The sum total of all your trust in me, does that prevail on you at all?" She says nothing.
"Do you know Bethany?" he says. "Her parents are into meth. So Will, the philosophy teacher at the high school,
took her in, and she lived with them for a while. And now she lives up Little Lake Road with a friend from school. This is Mendo. Everybody hates the system. Half of us are growers, and the other half are aging hippies, right? And then some are like my parents. Silicon Valley transplants, who believe in social services, but who deplore their present, underfunded, stagnantly bureaucratic iteration, and want them to be run by Google and financed by Scandinavians. What I'm saying is, nobody's gonna turn you in. Nobody wants you to go into a state or federally run institution. People will take care of you. Caroline would, in an instant. My parents would. So, what I'm saying is that if we call Will, that's the teacher I'm talking about, or hell, any teacher, if you have someone you trust, and they will take you into the hospital and tell the doctor you're their student, nobody's gonna call CPS. You'll be in and out of the hospital just fine. And they'd let me come back here? Jacob hesitates. I don't want to get away from my daddy, she says. And I don't think he would let that happen either. You need to get away, Turtle. He's my daddy. That was a pretty serious story you told. Not that serious. You could tell any teacher that story and you'd be done with this. She is silent. You could tell any teacher that story and in a moment, you'd be living with me, giving my sister scathing looks at the dinner table every night and learning all about wine and hearing about Dad's fascinating trips to Lehi, Utah, where there's always some riveting drama about defect analysis in silicon wafers, complete with intra-departmental romance. Misbehaving chemical engineers, you know, just an intricate story about how such and such an error got missed. We've got that bedroom for you, and Isabel would pay you to help in the studio. It sounds kind of good, right? She chews her lip. He could have hurt you badly. He didn't, she says. He won't. I think he will. You don't know what the fuck you're talking about. He doesn't want to hurt me. He loves me more than life itself. He's not a perfect person sometimes. Sometimes he's not the person he wants to be, but he loves me more than anybody else has ever been loved. I think that counts for everything. Not a perfect person sometimes? Jacob echoes. Turtle, your dad is a vast, a titanic, a colossal douchebag, among the worst to ever sail the lemon verbena seas. A primordial ur-douche, the depth and profundity of whose doucheism staggers the mind and beggars the imagination. Though, of course, Marcus Aurelius says that we should not despise others for hurting us. He says we should recognize that they act out of ignorance, against their will even, that you'll both be dead before long, and that this person hasn't really hurt you. Because they haven't diminished your ability to choose. And I think he's right. You don't have to hate him, but you might probably should really possibly think about leaving. By which I mean you should go to the hospital. Because only some kind of narcissistic sociopath could possibly object to you seeing a doctor right now. Anyone who cared about you, that'd be their top concern if they could see what I see. Everyone else, they'd be like, fuck it, my daughter's in pain. She has compound fractures in 3 fingers. We're going to the hospital. He is done with her pinky finger, applying antibiotic ointment and wrapping it in gauze. Then he traps the aluminum splint down over it and tapes it in place. He looks up at her. Next finger, he says. You ready? You don't know what you're talking about. I think I have some idea. You don't. He cuts away the cotton wrappings and reveals her left ring finger, swollen, the nail black. With the irrigation syringe, he blasts a thin jet of water and, to their surprise, the nail lifts from the bed, held fast by a few pale threads of flesh.
"Fucking motherfucking fucker fucking fuck!" Turtle says.
"What do you want me to do?"
"Rip it off."
"Shoot, I can't rip it off."
"Rip the fucking thing off."
He seizes the nail with forceps, cuts it free with surgical scissors, and drops it into the water.
"Motherfucker," she says.
"Keep talking. It seems like the talking helps."
"Fuck," Turtle says. "Fuck, fuck, fuck."
"Great. Now try sentences." "You don't know him."
"Turtle, this looks really bad."
"Jacob, you've only met him the once and briefly."
"You mean when Caroline dropped you off?"
"Of course that's what I mean. What do you mean?"
He tapes down the final splint.
"I kept expecting to see your finger bones sticking out, but I think the breaks are all closed and these cuts are superficial, which is good. I think. I don't know. You know who would know? A doctor."
"Jacob, did you meet him another time?"
"That's it for your hands. Let's see your back."
"Jacob."
She tries to pull her shirt up and over her head, but it's stuck to her. Wincing, she lies down on the towel. Jacob picks up the trauma shears and begins to cut away the shirt. He cuts from the hem to her neckline and tries to lift it, but it is fastened to her in bloody badges, and he takes his time, irrigating to soften the scabs and then pulling it away.
"You need a hospital. The shirt has been pushed into the wound."
"You've never even spoken with him."
"I did speak to him. He never told you?"
"I walked here from Mendocino after school. Your dad was on the porch, drinking beer and reading Descartes. I came up and I said I was looking for you."
Turtle is silent.
"He said you were away at your grandfather's house, and I asked him about Descartes, and he said he was reading the ontological proof for God's existence. He had a strange and interesting take on the proof."
"When was this?"
"Shortly after we met. Late April, early May, something like that. Prom was coming up, and I thought..."
"Did you tell him your name?"
"Yes."
"He asked how to spell it?"
"Some of these cuts are deep, Turtle."
"Did he ask where you live?"
"Yes, he did."
"Why didn't you say this before?"
"Did I get you in trouble?"
"No,"
she says.
"These look awful, Turtle. How did you not mention that you were this hurt?"
She lies on the floor and lets him irrigate the wounds and extract bits of shell. Late April, she is thinking. Early May. It must have been when she was out with Grandpa and Grandpa told her how to ask for the dress. His timing had been so bad. And her own. She almost cannot believe it. Jacob is drawing long strips of cotton out of the wounds on her back. She thinks, "He came here and he spoke to Martin and I never knew." "Christ," she thinks. After he leaves, she goes into Martin's room and picks up the phone book. She finds a single dog-eared page. There are learners and learners, but only one learner with an A. Learner, Brandon and Isabel, 266 Sea Urchin Drive. The name has a tick by it, a single blue pen stroke in the margin. Turtle stands holding the phone book. Jacob had talked to Martin. He had been talking to Martin on the day when Grandpa had been telling her how to ask about the dress. Perhaps Jacob asked Martin about prom. Then, when she'd asked about the dance, Martin had understood and he had pretended not to. He had waited for a sign from her. He'd gone up to her room, and she'd twisted away in his hands. He'd taken it seriously then. God damn, and how prescient he had seemed. How it had surprised her. Lying on the mud out in the yard and Martin bringing the iron poker down again and again. It had seemed that he could see into her heart. But that hadn't been it. He had known. He had met Jacob, talked to him, and hidden that fact from her. Grandpa had wanted her to go to the dance. Jacob talks to Martin. Martin understands. And when Turtle hesitates, when she pulls back, he knows what to do. Then the tidal pool and Buckhorn Cove. Grandpa's death. Martin's disappearance. And all because of what? She thinks. A boy, she thinks. No, she thinks. Because of what a boy represents. Turtle walks through the hall and down into the basement. Opening the cabinets, she takes down the most familiar bottle, SMZ/TMP. She stands looking up at the drugs. She has taken veterinary sulfamethoxazole, trimethoprim before, for urinary tract infections. She is looking at it. She cannot quite come to grips with what has happened. Martin's single blue tick mark by the address. It was meant for her. She knows what it means. If you cannot be controlled, he can. Jacob is nothing to him. Only her doubts. Only her straying. That is real. She takes down the card with Martin's notes on the SMZ/TMP. She reads it for a third time. She takes 3 of the 80-milligram tablets. She will take them twice a day. Then she takes down the Levaquin box. His note reads, anthrax inhalation, 500 milligrams, 60 Ds, for black plague. Others, 250 to 750 milligrams, Q, 24 hours. She dispenses the foil sheets with the 250-milligram red tablets in their extruded plastic bubbles and takes 2. She climbs back up the stairs, carrying the antibiotics. You cannot see Jacob again, she thinks. You cannot involve him in this. You cannot get him hurt. Her grandfather died for a mistake like this. And now, Jacob wants her to leave. It is all useless. All this talking, all Jacob's talking, all of her thinking, it is all useless. And what matters is already set in her, and it will not change, and she cannot be persuaded. She lies on her stomach across a wool blanket by the fireplace. Her thoughts rise through the murk of her mind like bubbles. She watches her little finger in its foam-lined aluminum splint pulse with her heartbeat. Her back, an old, half-rotted sponge, taking on achingly hot water. She thinks, when he'd found out, when he'd had the proof of her even thinking, even hesitating, he had pinned her to the muddy ground. She remembers the helplessness of it. That is the measure of his seriousness. She thinks, you cannot keep Jacob safe. Then she thinks, no, the truth is that you can, but you're not willing to. When she wakes, she stands by the counter eating Jacob's pancakes from the platter. She takes the tablets, drinks a glass of water. Sunlight pours in the windows, and she leans against the counter, watching the revolving motes of dust, each mote leaving a blurred trail like a comet. She goes into the bathroom, sits against the wall, sucking on the thermometer, and when she checks it, her temperature is again 99.2. She puts her fist against her forehead. You're okay, Turtle, she thinks. You're just worn out. She takes her antibiotics as regularly as she is able. In the mornings, She brews herself stinging nettle tea and goes out on the porch with her tea to watch the ocean. Several days a week, Jacob arrives with paper sacks brimming with food, piled under his arms, hanging from his wrists, and Turtle, sitting cross-legged on the floor in front of the fireplace, hands wrapped around a cup of tea, will look up and admire him. The first time was just a day or two after their return home, and he came with news.
My parents freaked when they saw my face. You should have seen them. They were like, "What happened?" And when I told them that I was washed out to sea and you came and rescued me, my mom said, "It's very dangerous to go into the surf to rescue a drowning person." And I said that you weren't afraid of danger, that danger was afraid of you. And they asked where Brett was in all this. And I said he was washed out too, only he had his easy cheese can, and he just triggered the nozzle and jetted away to safety.
"So you lied," Turtle says. I told Brett the whole story over the phone. He was pissed. He was like, "I miss everything." I told him how we were washed out to sea and how it was like making furious love to a clash of orgiastic rhinos in a swimming pool filled with broken glass, and how you made a fire by staring balefully down into the reflective bottom of an aluminum can until your immense force of will was concentrated and magnified by the parabolic mirror into a white hot spark of pure Turtle rage that could light anything on fire, even the hearts of unwary high schoolers.
What did he say? He had to admit that it might work.
I wish you wouldn't lie.
And then I said how you waited until the darkest part of the second night, just before dawn, and as the moon touched the horizon, you spread your arms and commanded the seas to part, and they parted as quickly and as widely as his mom's legs. And we walked back across the ocean floor with sea monsters basking in the pools, and how they called out to you with a siren song, and how you wanted to descend into the black and join them until I took your hand and led you away. It seemed almost like he didn't believe me.
When her back has scarred into thick pink keels, she goes shopping with Jacob's family, slouching uncomfortably around the fronts of stores while Isabel picks out summer dresses, saying,
"Oh, but you'd look so good.
Oh, but you have the perfect figure for a dress. Oh, look at this. Oh, please, please, Turtle. I'll buy you ice cream, anything." And Turtle massaging her knobby fingers while Isabel appeals to Jacob, saying,
"Jacob, tell her to try it on."
And Jacob putting up his hands, saying,
"I have no power over her. And if I did, I wouldn't squander it on clothes."
And Imogen saying, "I know where you'd squander it." And Isabel saying,
"Imogen."
And later, going shop to shop, Imogen announces, "I'm taking her to Understuff. Home Slice needs a bra."
"You're not," Jacob says.
"I am too, dingus," Imogen says.
"I am not a dingus," Jacob says.
"Social media is going to ban all photos of her, and she won't have any friends, and then she will die alone drinking wine from a box, and her hundreds of cats will close in and eat her face."
"That's not what you want for her, Jacob."
Turtle says,
"What?"
In the end, Turtle stands by herself in the changing room of the lingerie store. It all feels too posh. The room is uncomfortably large and the carpet unfamiliar. The walls are hung with silks. Imogen and Isabel throw bras over the door at her, and Turtle stands inside holding them and setting them on the chair while they describe, through the door, how the bra should fit. She takes off her shirt but cannot work the clasps. Her left hand is still clumsy. She is embarrassed that either of them should see her ruined back. She doesn't like her lean, ugly face in the mirror. She has slashes for cheekbones, squinty eyes. Her long blonde hair has the thick, wild texture of fur, partially dreaded. She stands stark and grimacing. Outside, she can hear Imogen and Isabel appealing to Jacob, and Jacob saying, "She's shy, guys." She stands in the dressing room. She holds the bra up. None of this matters, she thinks. They are preoccupied by things that do not matter. They do not see what it is, and they do not see what is important. She thinks, if this is what other people have, I don't envy it. When Isabel finally knocks, she calls, "Just a minute." Alone in her ancestral home, she waits beside the fire with an oil lamp, and she watches the flames, listening to the wind, imagining the blackberry canes creeping up between the floorboards to cast their green runners across her shoulders. Every day of it is good, and any day could be the last, though it feels as if he might never return. It feels as if this could be her life. Each day, she puts off telling Jacob. She is aware that it is the wrong thing, and it is a selfish thing. But it has been the same wrong, selfish thing since she met the boys above the Albion. She has always known it put them in danger. She is almost comfortable knowing what she needs to do and not doing it. She rubs olive oil into the pink wounds. Her joy is full and aimless. It accretes in layers under her skin and knits her pores tight. She sleeps folded in wool blankets in front of the fire. One night, her breasts aching and sore, she gets up and goes into the bathroom and sits there on the toilet. And she looks down to where a clue of blood unspools into the basin. She touches the pads of her fingers to her pussy and brings them up, daubed with her menarche. She puts them in her mouth and sucks them clean and then puts her fist against her forehead and cries for herself and for Martin. It is the end of something. She has been too skinny. Her body has had too few resources. She hunches over her naked knees and sobs. She does not want anything to change. She wants nothing lost. "You're making me fat," she tells Jacob the next day. He grins, putting the groceries in the cabinets. He is carefree. He thinks she's joking. He thinks they will go on like this forever. He is excited to help with her college applications. He stands in the kitchen, groceries laid out across the counter, a slab of lamb bleeding on the butcher block, a Dutch oven heating on the stove. With him crushing garlic cloves with the flat of the knife, shelling them, mincing them with an easiness and a calm domestic competence utterly alien to her, a kind of miracle. He is saying, "I am in love with George Eliot. My God, Middlemarch? That is a motherfucking book right there. Such a book. She has a wonderful, broad, generous style. She writes the way I want my letters to Congress to sound, you know?" As she watches him, she can imagine Isabel instructing him how to do it. A glass of wine on the counter and all of them, Isabel and Jacob and Brandon and Imogen, in the kitchen cooking some meal, which Jacob is cooking for her now. And Turtle can see, in the patient serenity with which he wheels around the kitchen, a whole inheritance of love. When Jacob is here, with her, the desire to touch him grows, becoming a kind of need, and she lets each moment of need pass her by, sitting there next to him, cross-legged, unable to do anything but look until sheer inactivity carries her through the unendurable moment. After he leaves, she will sit watching her fire, in love with wanting and not having, and sometimes, thinking of something he'd said, she'll grin and lie back on the blankets in front of the fire still grinning. Her moments of happiness occur right at the margin of the unbearable. She knows it will not last, and she thinks, "You can never forget, Turtle, what it was like here without him. You have to hold tight onto it, how good it is. Remember the way everything felt clean and good. There was no rottenness in any of it." But also, she thinks, how hard. Nothing is as difficult as a sustained and unremitting contact with your own mind. She thinks, does it matter if it is difficult? It doesn't matter. It is still better. Turtle Alviston, do you take this nothingness and this emptiness and this solitude? She thinks, do you take all these nights alone, and will you have this and only this for the rest of your life? 20. One morning she walks down to Buckhorn Beach with a bag of small, bitter apples from the orchard. She sits on the lee of a driftwood log. The tide is out and the bay is roiled. The wind comes stiff from the north and raises foot-deep slurries of sand that make every current visible. Seagulls huddle together in the lee of the northern cliffs. Where driftwood logs lay crosswise to the wind, eddies of sand collect in their wind shadows and mound up into ramps that match the log's silhouette. There is a constant scouring hiss. Behind each kelp heap, the wind cuts a V, leaving a gore where bark chips and bits of dried eelgrass accumulate, gyring and collapsing, toying together into balls. Sometimes, long strands of seaweed or sticks of driftwood spin up out of the eddy and go winging end over end across the cove and away to the south. She looks up the beach, and Martin is walking toward her, wearing jungle boots, 501 jeans, and a flannel shirt, shading his eyes against the wind, the gusts plastering the flannel to his chest. The light comes slantwise from behind him. The beach is sandy blue, the cliffs are dun brown, and Martin's footsteps throw gouts of sand into the wind. He comes within 10 yards of her, spreads his arms wide, his presence here a terrible trespass. And she loves this about him, sits looking at him, the wind whipping his long hair around his big, handsome face, him broad-shouldered and enormous as ever. She stands, dusts the sand off her butt, and walks into his arms. He smells like cigars and engine oil. They stand holding each other. Then Martin takes her by the arm, and everything is like before. He leads her away up the beach, and they follow the dirt track up the bluffs. Martin's truck is parked beside the highway at the bottom of the drive. He pulls out onto the highway and drives toward town with gear-shifting recklessness, taking the turns far out of his lane, looking over at her, chewing on his lower lip. There is a short-barreled AR-15 in the footwell, propped against the vinyl seat. The receiver has been milled out by hand for full auto. The vent holes in the exposed bolt carrier are streaked with filth. She sits beside it, and beside him, and thinks of those moments of solitude that had given her such pleasure and knitted her pores tight, but which had been so painful, so unendurable that she could not choose them for herself, given the choice. In the closed cab, she can smell him, feel him invested with tremendous weight. The presence like a well beside her in the truck cab, with its own sweet smell of WD-40 and of bad cigars crushed out in the ashtray. "Kibble," he says. "I fucked up. God, I know it." Jossette, driving recklessly fast but paying attention, shifting, punching the accelerator, passing a car on a blind turn. Roar of the engine, back into his lane, shifting, waiting, looking at her almost angrily. And then out at the road, gripping the wheel.